Welcome back to Elevation Trail with me, Tim Long, and Gary David. How are you doing today, Gary?
I'm pretty excited about this this new logo you launched. It's a pretty interesting looking. I think that it's bold. It makes a strong statement. I'm not quite sure what that statement is, but I'm sure whatever it is, it looks strong. And wow. That's all I can say is wow.
Well, I thought it was time for a change. And like I said in my Facebook post.
That's just what my wife was telling me last night. That's weird.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it is time for a change with us. And I meant to tell you this, but no, I'm just kidding. After 2 years, our two-year anniversary went by of you and I doing the show back in
2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hasn't it been? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought, you know what? It's time for a little bit of a change. Plus, I was getting kind of tired of that logo. I'd been using that finish line thing that was hand-drawn since 2003 with my old company, Racescapes Events. And yeah. I'd been using it for a long time, and I'd like kept reappropriating it for different logos, and I got a little tired of it. And I thought, you know what? I want to have something kind of more, like you said, bold. Clean. You know, something that'll look cool on a t-shirt, stuff like that. And then, you know, once I did it too, I had this guy, he's like, yeah, he bought one of my old shirts and he's like, yeah, I showed it to my brother and he thought that thing looked like a volleyball net. And I'm like, oh my
volleyball net.
Yeah. And then I looked at it and I'm like, God, it does.
Does it really?
So for 13 years now, I've been having a volleyball net.
The old one. Yeah.
My logo.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad we changed. And I like it a lot. I think it's pretty neat. And you know, if you listeners have not seen, which I can't imagine, we did start another t-shirt campaign. There's only a 25 shirt minimum in order to get them printed at the current price that we have, which is only $20 a shirt. So you get two things. You get a really cool shirt. They're black with the logo on the middle of the chest. You get to support the show and be really cool, actually. I mean,
I know.
In public.
And here's the thing about it, right? And here's the thing. It's not about the finish line, is it? It's about the adventure. It's not about getting to the end. It's about how you experience getting to the end. Mm. What? Exactly. So the idea that we've kind of shifted to this idea of what powers you from the inside, from what drives you from the inside, and there you have, you know, a piston in the middle of the logo, driving you, pushing you to do the things that we do to push those limits, to find those boundaries, to get outside of the comfort zone and not worry about where we end up, but enjoying how we got there. I think really that's the message you're pushing.
You nailed it. And you know, you and I hadn't even talked about the logo or the piston that I put into the logo, and people may look at it and be like, oh, okay, all he wants to talk about is motorcycles all the time. It's not even it.
It could be a crank arm.
The piston is the heart of any combustion engine in my head.
The heart.
And the piston also, for me, symbolizes legs in motion, like pumping the bike. It's exact same motion when you're pedaling a bike, running, all that stuff. I mean, and I think that you nailed it by saying that's the heart of or the essence of movement for
me. And also the Pistons were the basketball team for Detroit in the 1980s, the Bad Boys. And one might say that we are the Bad Boys of endurance podcasts.
We are the Bad Boys. And anyway.
So there's that too. And I don't know if you would be Dennis the Worm Rodman before he started freaking out a little bit, or if I would be Joe Dumars.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how we would kind of situate that.
Who is the little guy who is the
I don't Isaiah know, Thomas?
Him. I want to be him.
You want to be Isaiah?
Yeah, he was good.
Well, I mean, the whole thing with Isaiah was the whole sexual harassment issues.
I didn't even know about that. I don't want to be him. Sorry.
Later on, when the New York Knicks. Yeah, it's a whole thing. I don't know if you want to be
him. I got enough problems.
I don't know if you want to be Isaiah Thomas.
Need that rap, too.
Yeah, maybe Bill Laimbeer. I could see you being a Bill Laimbeer.
He was kind of a big, whiny guy.
Exactly.
I don't want to be him either. I don't want to be any of them, actually. I hate basketball. I think it's a stupid sport. Anyway, what else were we going to talk about? What's going on with you? You got a lot going on. You just wrote a really good article recently, and
yeah.
Actually, I'm going to share it on the Elevation Trail page on Facebook because I really enjoyed reading it. I thought it was it was poignant and extremely well written. And I was a little jealous that you wrote it actually.
So for those who don't know, I don't know why you would. There's a journal. Academic journals. It's quasi-academic, called Contexts. About a year and a half ago now, I think it's been, I submitted a manuscript to this journal on the birth of my middle daughter, Haley. And for those who might have listened to the show in the past or been, you know, keeping up with this stuff, she was born with a developmental disability related to her chromosomes, to her genetics, right? And so I wrote an article on that experience with somewhat of a sociological analysis slant to it. In technical terms, we would refer to this as an autoethnography, where you're able to use your personal experience as an analytical frame for exploring various social phenomena. That's how I would tell the kids about it. And so I submitted it, and actually one of the first reviews that I got back for this article was the suggestion I should take a writing course. I went, huh, all right. And so, you know, it's any time, and we're going to talk about this, I know, in today's podcast. What you see there, that final version, is the result of a long process and of revise and resubmission, of really kind of sweating over it, of really wrestling with, you know, word placement and paragraph placement and flow and concept, and working with a really good copy editor who helped out tremendously in helping to bring some elements of the voice out. And so it looks like, wow, this is really good. And I appreciate the comment, but it took a while to put together.
Yeah.
It was not a quick, like, I'm going to sit down and write something and just vomited words all over the page. I had actually been thinking about the first line of that piece for about 4 years, you know, trying to figure out what the hook would be.
Call me Ishmael.
Well, basically, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of, you know, the first line referring to following an ambulance down Route 2, you know, with a baby seat being empty in the back of your car, right? Mm. I mean, so just how do you capture that? How do you capture the experience in a way that draws the reader in and makes them want to read it?
Yeah.
And that's something we're not taught in academia, right? In graduate school, we're not taught how to write like that. More, you know, primarily we're taught how to write boring academic articles. So it pushed me a little bit, but it was also actually a good time to write.
Yeah. Well, it's good, and I'm going to share it on our Facebook page. What
so
else
that was
is
cool.
going
well,
on?
Well, next week I got the Whiteface 100K mountain bike race.
Oh, yeah.
And this last weekend I did something called the Monstrosity mountain bike ride, which ended up being a 60-mile, just over 60-mile mountain bike ride that took about 6.5 hours to complete.
That's pretty good time, actually.
Yeah, it was. It was a buddy of mine, Ben. He puts it together. Ben and Alexis put the ride together. And it's all, I mean, basically I was never more than 10 miles from my house, but able to ride for 6.5 hours. With a good group of people, posted a picture to fit to our Facebook page on that. It was really, really wicked hard. It was a hard day, but I was really pumped over how well I was riding.
And
I was riding stuff. I was riding stuff that I had not ridden before, and I attribute this to a few things. My newfound abilities. Number one, bourbon.
That's right. You've become a bourbon aficionado.
I have become a bourbon aficionado. For those listening, I would appreciate your bourbon recommendations. One of our listeners recommended Breckenridge bourbon, and I did buy some, and it was very good.
It's expensive, though, isn't it?
It's not bad. I mean, you know, it's. I haven't worked out how much you. I mean, because it's not like you're drinking a ton a night.
Well,
at least I'm not.
Yeah.
Yet.
Some of us.
Right. But you know, it's good. It's a nice experience. So bourbon number one. Two, reading books on outlaw motorcycle gangs has helped my mountain bike riding ability.
How so?
Because you read about these guys who basically are living with no fear, and then you look at yourself and go, wow, you're kind of a wuss. I'm saying this about me. So I'm like, you know, you really gotta kind of hulk up and go out there and ride with a little bit more aggression and a little bit more kind of an attitude of not being passive, but getting after it, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be number two. That'd be the second reason. And number three, I don't think you can underestimate the power of self-loathing for throwing all caution to the wind and being like, you know what? If I crash,
what's the myself, the worst thing's going to happen? I'll die, and then I'm done.
I probably deserve it, right? So if there's there needs to be an acceptable amount of self hate, and like I was telling my wife yesterday, I said it's really difficult to be in an abusive relationship when it's in your head. It's a relationship with yourself.
Can't get away from it.
Can't get away from it, and so you know. I was riding over this one feature that I've had a hard time with riding before, and I was kind of stalling out in the middle of it. And then before I put a foot down, I started, you know, yelling at myself in my head, being abusive, and it helped me to ride better. And if I crashed, you know what? I probably deserved to crash anyway, because who am I trying to be a mountain biker? So those three things.
Yeah, I do the exact same thing on the motorcycle. It's funny. It's if you ever watch any of the vlogs or videos that I put together or some of my rides, I do that all the time. And thankfully, it's not just in my head. I actually do say it. It's like, come on, you sissy, you can do that. It's nothing, kind of thing. And then I end up crashing, and that's over.
Yeah, and then you say, see, I told you.
Yeah, well, you are a sissy.
What are you trying to kid? What are you doing? Look at you. Look at you with your bike.
Yeah.
You're putting on vlogs as if you can ride. No one thinks you're a good rider. Yeah. I mean, people laugh at you. They don't even like your YouTube channel.
I don't.
So, you know, so what are you trying to do?
You're crystallizing exactly my thoughts recently. But anyway, you ask about my life. Thank you. I got a ticket yesterday.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
Aw.
Not just me, but my dogs got a ticket.
Were your dogs riding bitch?
No, we were walking, like we do every day around this park.
And a walking ticket.
So just to put it in perspective, my two dogs are both very small, and one is going to be 14 years old on June 21st and has very few teeth. And the other one had been abused. He's only 4 years old now, but he was mistreated and abused for the first 3 years of his life through two or three different owners and in and out of, like, shelters and stuff. So he's scared of all dogs and all people. And so these are the two dogs I have with me. Off-leash, which I honestly had no idea that there is a no-tolerance leash law in my county.
Zero-tolerance leash law.
Yeah, trust me, I almost flipped out. But anyway, so this lady pulls up in a truck on a sidewalk of around this park in this big pickup truck, and she's, you know, tells me this. And so I'm like, fine, I honestly had no idea. You know, and I see people over here throwing, you know, tennis balls to their dogs, and their dogs are running around off-leash all the time on the field. And so I walk around this park every day.
Right.
And, you know, I apologize, whatever. And I said, how much are the tickets? And she said, $300.
What?
Yeah. I was like, you know what? You can write the ticket, but I will never pay that.
$300?
Yeah, I told her. I'm like, you know what? I kind of like almost make minimum wage. That's like a week of work for me to pay these. And I even told her, I'm like, look at this dog. You know, he can barely walk, and he has almost no teeth. The other one won't even come near you. Neither of these dogs pose any threat to anybody. I walk around here all the time. Sorry, no tolerance. And I don't make much money either. That's what she tells me. So I was like pulsating with like adrenaline. I mean, I literally almost pulled her out of the truck and beat her to death because I was so angry. Mostly because I started thinking about all the people that I see walking around. And it's not like they do it and I do it, but it was just like, you know, I reached out to her and I'm like, personally, can you cut me slack on this one time and I'll never walk without leashes again? And she was like, nope, sorry, no tolerance.
Yeah, I'm looking at an article right now from the Grand Junction Sentinel. Leash laws unleashed. Dog owners could see more enforcement as authorities seek tighter grip on violators. That's you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're the violator.
So, yeah, we have this weird dichotomy now, of open, like everything else. You can walk around, you can shoot guns all over the place out in the open. Just go out to the field and start shooting guns. You can ride dirt bikes around. you know, God forbid you have elderly dogs and, like, abused, scared dogs off leash.
Now, this article here is saying citations are 50 for the first one, 100 for the second one, and 250, and a mandatory court date for the third.
Wow. That's interesting, because I have a mandatory court date, and my tickets are $300. Of course, that includes the fact that she couldn't find licensing. And I was like, well, I got this one dog's licensed in another state.
Right.
Because of my moving around nomad lifestyle. Nomadic lifestyle, and the other dog I got at the shelter legally here, and he has all his shots and everything and paperwork, and he even has a chip in him. And so, yeah, and he stays in the house 23 and a half hours out of the day, you know, or right. my backyard. And so I think they include licensing as well, fees.
Oh, that might be.
So, yeah, I that was the closest I ever came to going to jail for I did go to jail for physical violence. That was the second time I've almost had to go to jail for physical violence, because I literally almost ripped the door off her truck.
Well, you know what? You know why this is good, though?
How is this good?
Because it just increases the rep of our motorcycle gang. Because of the lawless nature of it.
I got a court date on July 7th.
Because you're going to be, we're going to be out there on a run to one of these major rallies someplace. And we're going to be swapping stories with other OMGs, outlaw motorcycle gangs. We're going to be swapping stories about run-ins with the law. And, you know, now we have one.
Yeah.
And so when they're talking about dealing meth or disorderly conduct or, you know, getting into a fight or pulling a knife or whatever, you can bring up your dog leash thing. And not only was your dog's not on a leash, they weren't even licensed, man. I don't even do licenses.
Yeah,
man, that's just the way normal people live. We live on the edge. We don't live by their rules. We
outlaw.
Don't need licenses. Outlaw. So totally. You're totally increasing our rep for the ETMC.
Yeah, that's the type of thing, and you know me better than a lot of people. This is the type of thing, last night's incident, that makes me move away from somewhere. Because I literally could pack up and be gone before lunch today. And I think I might. You know, I'm so angry about it. Like, just talking about it right now, my palms are sweating, and I feel like, angry.
On a side note, you should really John Oliver did an awesome piece on how municipalities make money off of fines and tickets.
Yeah, well, they're not going to make a penny off me. So yeah, I'll read that.
No, it's actually, you don't even have to read, because it's actually a video. So we can even post it to the Elevation Trail Facebook page, because he really does go into a lot of detail of how these things unfairly target low-income populations. And what's interesting, I know we want to talk a little bit about motorcycle vlogging today, because we have a guest on today about this, who's been doing an excellent job staying quiet. But in places like Germany and I think Switzerland, they actually have tickets, like moving violation tickets, that are scaled to your income.
Yeah.
And so if you go over the speed limit, it's not like here's the amount. Because, you know, $300 hits you harder than it would hit somebody who has a lot of money.
Yeah.
But they'll scale it to how much you make. So you can get like a $12,000, you know, speeding ticket. I mean, if you're of greater means than somebody else. So
that's the way it should be, I guess. But regardless, the fine doesn't meet the – I mean, I would – in order to get that ticket – amount of ticket on in a car speeding, I would have to be doing like 100 miles an hour in a 55, literally,
to get
that high of a ticket for reckless driving.
Totally ridiculous.
So anyway, yeah, they're not getting a penny out of me, and now I hate the county, and I hate where I live, and I'm probably going to move. So screw you, Mesa County.
Anyway,
you brought up our guest, and you know that I've been doing these moto vlogs a lot lately. I know I've been pushing them, we're going to talk about that too. I put a lot of time into them, and so I also watch a lot. I mean, my daily routine is I usually get up pretty early, and I'll spend a half hour watching new vlogs of people that I enjoy watching. And you know, so I've been communicating with this other guy over on the other side of the Rockies, which I may be moving over there soon, back over there.
He was going to do a search on lenient leash laws.
I know. You know, and, yeah, just to clarify, had I known that there was a leash law everywhere, because I literally was ignorant of that law, which is not an excuse, but holy crap. Anyway, so I've been talking to this guy. We've exchanged stickers. He has his own stickers too.
So I guess you could say it's gotten pretty serious.
Pretty much. Unlike a lot of our listeners, he actually purchased an Elevation Trail t-shirt without even knowing us or ever listening to the podcast. He just did
it. Has he purchased a new one?
I'm sure he will.
Yeah, well,
he's a good guy. Plus, he's actually the guy that told me that his brother said that the old logo looked like a volleyball court.
It kind of looked a little like a volleyball
So anyway, but so he and I have been chatting. He's actually going to do like a cool little trip all on dirt over the mountains to this side of the state this week, and so we'll get to ride together this week
nice.
At some point. Anyway, so I've been watching a lot of his videos, and they're pretty cool. I mean, you can tell that he's like me in a lot of regards. So he likes to get these videos out as quickly as possible. And he focuses more on the content, I think, than the quality. And he can correct me on this, and he may be upset that I said that, but it's good because I enjoy the content a lot. You can go out and find anybody who can put together a video decently, but if the content's not interesting, it's still kind of like, you know, a little bland.
For you, what makes a good video?
I would say if someone takes the time to actually edit it down to, it's almost like, not a poem, but a short story. If, you know, a short story has to be a certain length, and in that regard, you have to peel away all of the extra garbage that people tend to put into, like, blogging. You know, all the writing that we see nowadays is just like, oh my God, get to the point. So it has to have a point to it, and it has to be somewhat unique in a way that, you know, wow, I never thought of that, or I never thought of that that way. That's interesting. You know, kind of like our show.
Right.
No, what we do all the, well, what we, what Absolutely. You do all the time.
All the time.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what I think he does. He does various kinds of blogs or vlogs. Some of them are just rides. Some of them are modifications to his motorcycle. And the cool thing I like about that is it's kind of like do-it-yourself, and you're learning along with him because you can tell, like, he doesn't know what the hell he's doing half the time. And
right.
But he's got the tools, the correct tools to do it. He did the proper research. He got the, you know, the parts that he needs, and he goes about doing it. And it's I like it because it's similar to what I've been going through over this last year, learning how to rip my bike apart and put it back together. So I've been watching his stuff, and I thought, you know what, this guy, I enjoy his vlogs, and you know, he put it this way. When he sent me the sticker, he like hand wrote a little letter. You know, I couldn't read it because his handwriting's not so great. But
it is a lost art.
It was kind of cool getting the letter in the mail, and I thought, you know what, this guy would be kind of fun to have on the show. We had our CrossFit dude last week, so why not turn it around and have a motorcycle guy on the show too?
Motorcycle human.
Yeah, motorcycle human on the show. Right. So I'd like to welcome our good friend, our new good friend, Brandon Pooley, to the show. Are you in Denver, Brandon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the leash laws?
What are the leash laws here?
Yeah, what are the leash laws like over in Denver?
Jeez, I have no idea. You know, I've never been cited for it, never had anybody mention anything.
I think it's more lenient, because I know for a fact in Boulder, they have, you can take your dogs on the trails, which is amazing because they're so overpopulated, the trails. And as long as you have a permit for voice control, you have to show that you have control of your dog by yelling at it and keep it within like 15 feet or something. You can. I know there's no leash there. So anyway, welcome to the show, Brandon. How are you doing? Well, I know you. What'd you go? Did you get about an hour of sleep last night?
About 3 hours.
That's good. Yeah. So I saw it. I noticed that he posts on like Facebook at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And so I'm not sure he's slept much in the last couple of years.
Oh, Jesus.
What do you do for work, or are you just a student?
I'm an internal student. I haven't worked in a little while. My last job was in publishing.
Publishing what?
Game rule books for tabletop role-playing games.
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mentioned to Tim that I had worked with a bunch of guys from Britain. It was actually for this company, Black Library. I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but yeah, I had to do a bit of work for them.
That Black sounds, Library.
Sounds like a library that outlawed motorcycle gangs would go to.
Oh, yeah.
You guys want to meet at the Black Library? Have some cafe, some coffee, and talk some poetry, some T.S. Eliot. Anyway, yeah, so amongst other things, so you're a student studying what?
Chemistry at the moment.
Oh, interesting.
And so a guy, wait, let me back up a little bit. So a guy who published role-playing who is a chemistry student.
Sounds...
So how many lists, government lists do you think you're on right now?
Oh, several.
Right.
And for more reasons than just my own, but that's a different Gary, story.
Gary, if you've ever seen his Moto Vlogs, which is his channel is Adventures in Real Life, you'd probably start toning down some of your comments towards him because his house looks like the Unabomber. Now that I know he's a chemist. And
right.
The whole role playing thing, and he works on his motorcycle in his living room.
Of course. Where else would you work on it?
Yes.
Had the best lighting.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, he's totally ETMC material. I mean, because we need a guy in a government list.
So Gary mentioned ETMC for you listeners that might not be hip to that. We have started a motorcycle gang.
Right. Club.
The club.
There's a bunch of guys who like to ride around and have a good time.
Yeah. So Gary doesn't have a motorcycle yet or his license, but
or a permit.
He's one of the officers of the club.
I am.
And Brandon, we're going to rope him into it too because he's got a big 250 bike.
Nice.
And it's green.
Things are shaping up nicely.
With stickers all over it.
So how long have you been doing like the motorcycle thing?
About 2 years now.
And why'd you start?
Really, my uncle really got into the whole desert racing scene back when he lived in Utah. And he moved to Colorado and he brought over all of his motorcycles. And my dad, I guess he did it when he was younger, but just got out of it with my mom. She was completely saying it was dangerous. Don't ever do it. But I guess since we're all adults now, all my siblings and I, so my dad got us all back into it. He, you know, bought us a bunch of bikes, and that was about 2 years ago. They were mostly just like 125 little dirt bike things, and it was only about a year ago that I went up to a 250.
And what's the difference, like, for those who are listening, not like me, who, like, obviously knows a lot about motorcycles, but for other people, what's the difference between that kind of step up?
So, for off-road, for trail riding, which is most of the stuff that I do, most of the stuff that Tim does, usually a 125 will get you anywhere you need to go on anything that you could get on with, or that you could get through with a Jeep, or like a four-wheel drive vehicle. But the problem, I guess, with those is that they just can't really maintain a very high speed. They work fine for anything that you'd want to do off-road, pretty much. But you just can't get a very high speed. You can't carry around any weight worth anything. And really, if you make them road legal, you can't get anywhere with them. So
you can't carry an old lady on the back of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they don't even have passenger seats. I mean,
oh, you got to have one for your old lady.
I know. Well, I need to annotate these conversations to introduce our folks into the motorcycle gang. Old ladies are the guys' girlfriends who are in the club, the guys, and so old ladies.
Yeah, I mean, she's not club property.
Not club property.
They're not like women who just kind of hang around. They're actually property of one guy in the club.
They typically wear patches on their vests or jackets that say property of,
not club patches, because that's not
correct, just a patch that says property of Spike or whatever your name,
Brandon, property of Brandon.
Yeah, so you don't want to take an old lady on your 125. It's kind of a tiny bike.
No, you really can't carry anything at all. You can't do anything too terribly aggressive. It's really just a bike for someone who's really new and doesn't really plan on doing anything intense at all. So you switch up to about a 250, and a 250 is adequate for pretty much everybody. I mean, they are solid bikes. You can gear them so high that they won't be able to be useful at all on road, but they will work fine on any trail you'd ever want to do, I imagine, or at least any trail I've been on in Colorado. Really, the size of the engine matters more for speed and for, I would say, hill climbs to some extent. But mostly, if you want to do speed and you want to carry a lot of luggage or another person, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good explanation of it. I'd say a 125 would be fun. I've thought about it, like getting a 125 two-stroke bike, but it just, I mean, all I would picture myself doing is kind of putting around out in the desert. You know, you can't, like you said, you can't get much speed out of it, and there's no power. And
it just gets you from point A to point B, and it doesn't do it very fast. It's definitely not going to do it with anything fancy. It's just gonna get you there.
Yeah, and it's a little bit safer in that regard too, because it's
oh, yeah,
you know, twist of the throttle is not gonna send you to the moon. So if you just want to get out and explore, I think it would be a great bike actually for someone who just wanted to get out. Like, so a lot of our listeners are a lot of the 8 listeners that we have are runners and or mountain bikers. So I think like a 125 dirt bike, if they live in an area that allows it, would be a great way to get further out into, you know, the more remote places, I guess.
Well, and the real advantage of those bikes is that they're incredibly light. I mean, my sister has a KLX 140L, which is a 144 cc bike, and it weighs just a little over half what mine does. Mine is about 270 pounds, and hers weighs 160.
Wow.
Jeez.
So you can just for me, I can just go and just pick it up and carry it around.
Especially if you did CrossFit, you could just kind of grab that sucker and just, you know, do reps with it and jump on it and jump over it. It'd be awesome.
Drag it around behind you from your belt.
Run with it, dragging it. Oh yeah, you can do all kinds of stuff with that.
So the 250 is adequate for a lot of like what people do, but you're thinking about like doing adventure riding, like you said, over that you're doing a quote unquote small adventure ride over to the Western Slope where I live, which will end up being what, about 400 mile trip or something like that?
Yeah, it's 380 miles. It's, you know, kind of iffy depending on how roads go and how accurate my measuring stick is.
Is 380 one way?
Yeah.
Wow, you're going really out of the way then, because I think if you shoot down just straight across on the highway, it's only like 250 miles or something like that, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so you're going an obscure route for sure. But anyway, so back to that, that is weird to me. Like taking a 250 on a long trip like that would be akin to like riding your mom's like...
Don't talk about my mom that way.
Your mom's 3-speed bicycle across the country.
Well, I mean, you do say it. My bike does have its bore, so it is bored up to 350.
Oh, yeah.
So it is a bit more powerful than the stock bike, which is a 250. And it does have a lot more modifications. It is a lot more powerful than your typical 250 engine bikes or even a 350 engine bike. It isn't quite as good as a KTM 350, but it is more capable of carrying luggage. It is a lot more comfortable for road style riding. Yeah. And the thing is that a lot of people started this culture of doing what they call adventure touring, where they, instead of touring with a motorcycle that's really designed for road and is kind of just like a car that's open and on two wheels, they started using dual sports or very heavy ones. They call them adventure bikes, like the GS1200, which is a BMW bike with some off-road capacity, or Triumph Tiger, which is another one of these made by Triumph. And they take these bikes just because they're able to do some off-road capacity, see some sights that they wouldn't be able to without having a bike that would be capable of such things. Mm. However, these bikes can't really do anything more intense than maybe a primitive road at best.
Yeah.
I mean, or like anything past that. I mean, even some primitive roads would be too rough for one of these bikes, especially considering that they have a price tag usually of 15,000, 17,000, however much for these nice BMW bikes or whatever. So out of this, there's been another surge in the past 4 or 5 years of this culture of using dual sports as adventure bikes. And they're usually sticking with the very, very large dual sports, like the 650s, the KLR 650, the DR 650, which is Kawasaki's and Suzuki's dual sport, heavy dual sport bike.
They're still pretty big, heavy dirt bikes, basically.
Hey, Brandon, how much time do you spend reading about this stuff, Brandon? You're starting to...
you sound like Gary.
Yeah, I know. You're like, I got the da-da-da-da-da, and then you got that. Oh, yeah, of course. Well, yeah. Spend a lot of time reading about this stuff?
Oh, I read until I feel pretty sure about myself when I do anything.
I'm actually on the Triumph webpage right now for motorcycles, and there are a lot of bikes there.
Yeah.
Again, as a person who doesn't know much about motorcycling other than the 3 or 4, you know, source materials that I'm reading for my 25-question permit test, just on the Triumph website, there's a lot of bikes. And so has the bike industry kind of exploded in terms of the offerings? Is this like a recent thing, or is this something that has been going on for quite some time? In terms of the specificity of, you know, a bike for adventure, or a bike for dual use, or a bike for sport, or a bike for touring, or a standard bike, and etc.
In the case of adventure bikes, it's only really been about since 2006, 2008 maybe at the latest, that they've really started. And part of this was from a movie that it was a TV series that I don't know if either of you have seen called Chips. The Long Way Round.
Oh, no, different one.
Yeah.
So Brandon's too young for Chips. He probably doesn't even know who the hell that is.
No idea.
Really? You don't?
Really?
I was joking.
Chips? No, seen Chips?
Eric Estrada? Are you kidding me?
Oh, my God.
California Highway Patrol?
Oh, no, my God.
Punch?
All they did was ride around and, like, stop really hot girls in Ferraris.
Yeah.
Hey, you knew you were speeding, right? Hey, you want to go out for a drink? Okay, baby. Yeah, that's
you better put your dog on a leash. You gotta go and watch Chips. That's like the thing.
Yeah, it's iconic America. Right. Anyway, so yeah, unfortunately,
Long Way Round.
Gosh, Long Way Round. With have you? Do you know about that, Gary?
Long Way Round. Of course. I'm looking at it right now on Google.
That's pretty cool, actually.
I did hear about it though. Yeah, I do. As I look at it, I do remember. And yeah, you kind of remind me like a Motorcycle Diaries kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know what you're describing.
So in this series, two guys, I can't remember exactly. Oh, Ewan McGregor and I. It was one of his friends from early in his acting career.
And the other guy, right?
Yeah, they went around the world, I guess across Asia, going off the beaten path. They went off road, or at least off pavement, on big GS 1200s, which were just barely introduced by BMW, and it was really a novel idea, and it really kind of stuck with a lot of people who saw this series, and they really thought it was great to be able to think, hey, I can go on a motorcycle tour and I can go and visit some places that I couldn't otherwise. Like on my trip that I'm planning out to see Tim, there's a couple of places that I wouldn't realistically be able to see on a road motorcycle, like the Colorado Monument or the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. Mm-hmm. Very well. So this type of motorcycle is really a novel thing. They haven't made heavier motorcycles designed for touring up until about 2006 when they introduced this particular model of bike. KTM introduced their 990, which is a very, very adventure-oriented bike.
Very expensive. Yeah.
They all are very usually expensive. They all are usually very expensive.
That's what I like about what you kind of did with yours, is you turned it into one of those smaller versions of those bikes for... I mean, literally a small fraction of the price, because those bikes are kind of, they romanticize that whole aspect of adventure motorcycling, and they market it to kind of like the rich kind of folks, I think. And so you've kind of like given the poor man a chance to do the exact same thing on a very similar yet lower powered bike.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, what a lot of people are doing is they're taking that KLR 650. It's the most popular dual sport sold for this reason, because it is half as expensive as its comparable models, and they will do the same thing that I have done. However, I'm one of the few people who's tried to do it with a very small bike. The reasons why I chose to do it with a very small bike over something like a KLR 650 engine or 800 engine bike is that no matter what you do with one of these larger bikes, it won't be as capable off-road as you might want it to be. It can't do single track. It can't do the really rough primitive roads. It can't do jeep trails. There's just no way. And if you're by yourself and you drop the bike, it's really hard to pick up a 400-pound bike with all of its luggage weighing it down. So what I really wanted was an off-road bike that would feel comfortable on road.
Mm.
So this is actually a newer and even kind of newer emergence of culture that no one, that people haven't really explored all that well, especially YouTubers. But it's just a more novel concept that came out of Adventure Rider, and just something I like the idea of exploring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, just to kind of bring it around to make your point too, like my bike is licensed for the road, but I would say, and usually when people talk about dual sports for road and dirt, they give it like a percentage, like, well, what percentage is it road and what percentage is it dirt? A lot of these are like 60-40, like 60% dirt, which means they have some knobby tires, and 40% road, which means they're still comfortable on the road. Mine's kind of like 95% dirt and 5% road. It's extremely uncomfortable. When you said you were going to ride 380 miles one way over here, I was like cringed because I get sore after 10 miles on my motorcycle on the road. But on dirt, yeah. I can ride all day because you're standing up so much. But I'm hoping to get Gary, because he and I are in the process right now of deciding what kind of bike he needs for our club.
Right.
And so we're in the process. Gary's taking his test. But I think both of them, you're taking your motorcycle class, which includes the road test, on the 20th and 21st of June, so 3 weeks from now. And your written test is when?
Well, the way it works here, the way it can work here, is that you go into the RMV and you do your permit test, which is, you know, your 25 questions, sit down at a computer and, you know, talk about, you know, stuff, whatever they ask. And then after that, you can either do the road test at the RMV, or you can take a class, which is, 2 days long, all day, which includes a written component and a road test component. And if you pass that, then you get your license automatically without going to the RMV and doing their road test.
Yeah. So it is a little more pricey, but it is, you know, it serves obviously several purposes. One, it'll get you more comfortable on the bike. You learn a lot more. And precludes the whole need of taking the test with the RMV, which is called the DMV in the rest of America.
Well, the important thing that it provides you with is a motorcycle, which I don't have.
You're doing it the exact opposite way I did it.
For the price, you know, which is like $325, you get to actually ride a motorcycle.
Yeah, just don't drop it. I heard if you like drop the thing that you're like automatically fail the class.
Yeah, that would be a bad thing. but you know, I have such mad mountain biking skills now.
Which helps. It does.
I would imagine would have to, you know, have to help out quite a bit. But at the same time, there's a lot going on. I mean, because in terms of the coordination with, you know, the braking and the clutch and the throttle and, you know, what you're doing with your feet and, you know, and your right hand with brake and then the shifting and upshifting. Honestly, without joking about it, there's a lot of coordination that goes into this. And so, you know, the idea of doing a test without ever having been on a bike, I'm hoping once I get my permit, I can go with my buddy Ben and use, like, he has like a 250 Nighthawk, and just go in a parking lot someplace and practice just getting a feel for, you know, throttle and, you know, shifting and things like that.
Yes.
So
on that point too, a lot, you know, some of our listeners may have never ever ridden a motorcycle. So the way it kind of
like
works
me.
It's a lot of coordination. So just to a basic overview, your left hand is handling the front brake lever. your right hand is handling the throttle. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No,
your
wrong.
Left, your left hand is shush. Your left hand is handling the clutch, which some a lot of people don't even drive clutch cars or manual cars. So your left hand's handling the clutch, which you have to pull in to shift gears. Your right hand's handling two things, the throttle and the front brake. Your left foot's handling the shifting, and your right foot is handling the rear brake. So all your appendages, almost all your appendages, are working in unison to make this thing move.
And where are your knees, Tim? Where should you position your knees?
Well, it's different for dirt biking.
I'm talking about a road bike, Tim. This is a road bike test, not a dirt bike test.
I don't position your knees on a road bike. You just where they bend against the tank.
Against the tank for increased stability.
Yeah, well, that's the same for dirt biking then too. You use your legs a lot for dirt biking.
You stand up and then you.
Yeah. You found out recently that it's illegal to stand up on the road on a bike?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, well, I had a recent video where I asked a cop about it. He had no idea. Everyone I've ever asked had no idea, but one of my subscribers went and looked up the law and saw that, I guess the law it's more intended for people not riding side saddle or
stunting, doing stunts. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, it's that.
Because immediately when I saw you posted that and said, oh, yeah, it's illegal to stand up, I was like, because I ride over, obstacles on the road all the time, like bad roads or manhole covers or stuff like that, and I stand up over those all the time, so it was odd. But, of course, Brandon was getting pulled over for speeding, and what does he do? He's like, instead of talking about the speeding ticket, he's like, oh, by the way, do you know if it's legal to stand up?
Right.
Well, I was curious.
Of course.
I had an opportunity. I've gotten a lot of speeding tickets in my life, so I've gotten pretty used to them.
So he's totally perfect for the ETMC.
I know. Let's make the cop feel stupid while he's writing a
speeding
ticket.
He's a chemist. Do you play Magic? Do you play Magic?
Oh, not for years.
See, I mean, so if he does that whole thing, I mean, you got the leashes. Yeah, we're totally on edge. So this is good.
Yep. We'll be in one of the books that Gary and I are reading soon.
So, Brandon, when did you decide that your life was interesting enough to put on YouTube?
Ugh. When did I decide that?
I'm kind of curious because one of the things Tim and I have talked about is, at what point are, people put themselves out there, right? And so at what point did you say, you know what? I got something to contribute. I got something to offer. I'm going to put something on YouTube about, what it is I do.
Great question.
Well, that is an actually phenomenal question. So you said my channel name is Adventures in Real Life. And that was actually not actually originally used as a moto vlog. It wasn't used for YouTube. I used it as a blog where when I was actually making this vlog, I thought about what I wanted to write about. And I thought, I want to write about my adventures in real life. And really, it must have been then that I decided that my life was interesting enough to put on the internet, given at the time what I had been writing about was mainly just literary tropes and how they related to things in my life, storylines in my own life, and how I could relate them to other things that already existed and fashion them into stories. So when I made a motovlog, I thought that was just a great name and I would just reuse all the branding from that, the same thing with the compass that I use for my channel. It's all from that, and it's just the concept of what I want to make and just stories of my adventures that I have in real life.
That sounds amazingly familiar, doesn't it, Gary?
Pretty familiar, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Elevation Trail was originally a blog that wrote articles about running and endurance sports and stuff, and then we started the podcast from there. And now it's grown into a video channel also with an amazing amount of subscribers.
Amazing.
So it is it's a neat evolution though of like Gary said, what made you want to do that? And it's kind of just it evolves over time, and I think with the media that's available and the things that are available to put it out into different formats, that's what kind of the content almost stays very similar. I bet the content in your videos is very similar to what it was in the blogs.
Well, it didn't involve motorcycling.
Yeah,
in the
but the way that you present it, you know, and you know, the storylines and things like that, and the tone of it and the feel. In I think, you know, like when I started my channel, gosh, I started my channel video YouTube channel back in 2007, and I was using a point and shoot camera to videotape runs. They were fascinatingly exciting to watch. I would video runs up on mountains and stuff like that and chit chat. So it was basically like vlogging that we do today without the moto. But yeah, I used like a point and shoot camera. I think the resolution was like 380. Something like that, or 240. I mean, it was like ridiculous. The pixels were as big as your hand. And, you know, nowadays everybody can get like an action camera. I think I saw them at Walmart for like $50 for some of them. And YouTube's free, and, you know, the software you can get for free. So it's pretty easy to get into, which leads us to the problem that we saw with blogging. Whereas right. back in the old days, without the internet, writing, you had to have good writing or interesting content to get published and therefore have people read your stuff or have it in public. Nowadays, any schmo can have a blog. So things get watered down and you have to sift through a lot of stuff to find decent things. Good and bad. Everybody gets a chance to do this stuff now, but it's difficult to find the good prizes out there that really that you enjoy
watching.
It's a
lot of noise. Yeah. A lot of noise.
Exactly. Yeah, so a lot of my time is spent watching videos that I wish I had that 5 minutes back out of my life to do something else because they're awful. Same with writing and stuff like that. I'm not saying mine are any better. I'm just saying the things I enjoy reading and watching, it's very difficult to find through all this stuff.
Yeah. And with this whole moto vlogging experience, there is a lot of watching other people's stuff just because you just have some connection with them or you feel obligated to it or whatever. Oof.
Well, so, and a way to promote your channel. I actually did a vlog on this a couple of months ago talking about it. You can tell when people use other people's channels to like promote themselves, sometimes overtly, like, hey, that was a great video, check out my stuff when you get a chance. And sometimes a little more subtle, like, hey, that was really good, I did the same thing once before too on my channel, you know. And it's like so they try to drive traffic, and it's very obvious when people do that.
Yeah. No,
well, I mean, is it about book sales, right? I mean, and so of course people want to make something that's appreciated and gets liked. But is that the sole motivation, or is it to create something that can stand on its own? And it's, you know, I'm not asking everyone to be, you know, Francis Ford Coppola making Apocalypse Now, but as I was saying about the piece that I wrote that just got published, that was like over a year and a half in development for a 3,000 word article, where I really did look at every word and think about what was going on with it, and other people looked at every word and thought about what was going on with it. And do people, you know, as we were talking about before we started recording, does ease of use and efficiency of the technology mean that you should then do it? You know, it doesn't mean it's higher quality just because you can record something very easily and upload it very easily. It doesn't mean that it should be uploaded.
And quite frankly, too, I think a point that you're kind of getting at also is people's tastes have changed over time because of what's available out there. They want something that's quick to read or see, and, you know, it gives a little bit of eye candy or mental candy, I guess. You know, they don't want it. Like, your piece that you wrote is exceptional. However, is it going to be popular, I guess, to like when I post it? Well, it'll be interesting to see when we post it on our Elevation Trail Facebook page to see how much traffic it gets and stuff, when it's probably 10 times better than anything we've talked about on our show or written about on our Facebook page. And yet I bet if we put a picture up of a kitten and mentioned like racism or something like that in the same like post, we would get
a racist kitten.
Racist kitten, like a black kitten who doesn't like white kittens, something like that.
Why would you have to make the black kitten be the bad one?
It wasn't bad. I was saying that.
How come it couldn't have been the white kitten that didn't like the black one? How come you had to go with the black kitten being the one who didn't like the white one?
I don't know. I don't know.
Must have been because you're from Flint. Must have been that Flint. I mean, well, we could do a whole psychological analysis of that right there.
My high school was 87% black.
Black kittens at your high school?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, Gary, you made a great point about how people, if just because things are easy, if people should go and post stuff on the internet just because it's easy to make content. And in my opinion, I think people actually should go out and just post things, but so long, with one caveat, just so long as they are willing to learn something and improve their work as they go along, and that they don't expect to get any response from it. Just because they made something, it doesn't mean anybody should care.
But yeah, and you told me last night when we were chatting that you did a lot of market research, which I don't have the patience to go through, on YouTubing and how some of the real big channels aren't that big in moto vlogging. I mean, it's a very small little niche market. It's, you know, it's not like a PewDiePie channel. I don't even know how many he has now. He's like, what, 18 million subscribers, something like that. It's just ridiculous. And he makes on YouTube, for folks that don't know, you can make good money if you have a big channel. You get, like, I don't know what the numbers are, but if you have a decent sized channel, like say even as small as 100,000 subscribers, and you post regularly, you can live off that easily. You know, so we in motovlogging, a big channel is anywhere, I would say, like 50,000 is a huge channel. A 300,000, like Jake the Snake, or Jake the Garden Snake, motovlog channel.
Jake the Garden Snake.
Yeah, he's out of Florida or somewhere down in the south. I mean, it's like, and I hope that he doesn't, or they, people that watch his videos don't hear this podcast, but I don't really like his videos. And, you know, the quality of them isn't that awesome, and the content doesn't inspire me at all, and yet he has 300,000 subscribers. It's amazing. Well,
my thinking with that is just that he just has this whole ADD persona about him. He's just crazy, just rambles off stuff all off the top of his head, and he's always very fast-paced. So I think he was one of the early guys, and he just was able to get this very fast action, very fast paced content, and people enjoyed that. And for someone like me, if you've seen my random road videos where I just make it very fast paced, but in reality I'm usually very quiet, very slow, but I go and I cut out any silence in my videos just to make it that equally fast paced.
Yeah, they're bizarre.
Oh yeah, totally. But you really have to pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, I guess my point is that it's difficult to – well, two things. One, it's difficult to now I remember what I wanted to say. Gary, save me. Come on.
You can reach in there and do it. Come on now. I'm just trying to think about why someone would name themselves a garden snake.
I don't understand.
Oh, it's weird YouTube names. There's all random ones. Like, there's this guy with – like, Jay gave me a DRZ, which I always want to pronounce Jagavmigrzda.
Yeah.
See, when I watch like the stuff from my YouTubers that post the cross country ski videos, like Skiing Vinny, I get it. Tells me everything I need to know. His name's Vinny, and he does skiing. All right,
Vinny ski videos.
I see. I type in Jake the Garden Snake into Google. I don't know what the hell is going to pop up.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, like the guy M13. All right, that's kind of edgy, kind of cool.
Well, that's from his name is Mordeath 13. And he, yeah, over time, his branding changed down to M13.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I get it. It's pretty cool. I like it. Okay, it's kind of got this like James Bond kind of thing, or this undercover, almost quasi-video game vibe going. Cool. So I don't know. You know, Jake the Garden Snake, I don't know him. He's from Florida. That kind of scares me, too. Florida is kind of a frightening place. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm just kind of trying to get my head around the whole element of how people who do these motorcycle things post on names on YouTube. And also, now that you're talking about how motorcycling has kind of really expanded out, I mean, if you talk, we used to talk about like the original schism in motorcycling, right? Was the one percenters, where the American Motorcycle Association would talk about 99% of motorcycle riders are very respectful people, citizens, good people. It's only the 1%. So you had like this us and them thing happening, and now you have like this multiple fractions going on across the motorcycling quote unquote community. And so it's kind of interesting to see how, like, you know, the industry is responding with the bikes. It's driving it with the different bike options, but it's also being driven by the different requirements that are being asked for. When I was reading this book about Sonny Barger, who was, you know, former head of the Oakland Hells Angels, he talked about in his book how a lot of their chop downs on their bikes, and this is where the word chopper comes from, how a lot of the modifications they made to their bikes actually drove design decisions up by Harley-Davidson. So it's kind of interesting to see this, you know, this feedback loop happening between the people who are actually doing the stuff and the people who are designing the stuff and the different, you know, mediums that are influencing what's going on in the motorcycle space.
Oh, that, yeah, that totally feeds into what I was talking about earlier, because bikes now that are heavy dual sports are now designed for more road use. So it's no surprise that there's this feedback between use and production.
Yeah, and a lot of the companies use motovlogging, like Adam Reinman does a lot of stuff for KTM and puts together some amazing, you know, adventure like motovlogs. He actually did a small film too where he and his buddy rode from the KTM manufacturing shop in Austria all the way down to Egypt to the pyramids, and it was an awesome video. But yeah, so there's a lot of give and take between the two. But back to your like market research that you did when you started doing your channel, you know, I found it amazing that, like I was saying, some of the huge channels, I find the not only the content not that interesting, and I'm not saying all of them, I'm just saying a couple of them, and it's just my opinion, obviously. I find the content not that interesting, and also the production is sloppy, I guess, for lack of a better word. And then you find some of the small channels, you know, tiny, when I say small, like, you know, low numbers of subscribers, have super high quality and are really good content, I think. And, you know, you can tell that they take the time to put these things together. And it's just, it makes you wonder, you know, what it is. And I think, like you mentioned last night, do you think it's a lot of, like, who you know and networking through the vlog channels?
Well, I think that's part of it. But particularly for these large people, every single one of them, everybody above, because I looked at a pretty wide range of people. I looked at 80 channels pretty in depth. And everyone above around 10,000 subscribers had existed for at least 2 years. Hmm. And I mean, not just that their channel existed, I mean that from when they started actively trying to release a video at least once a month that was specifically catering towards motovlogging, trying to establish themselves. And it really is just time more than anything else. I was very surprised about that. I did math, I did statistics back, and really, the best channel out there mathematically was, that didn't have any relationships with this, of having known people or anything else, was Riding with Tom. And this guy got famous just by making videos where he would review bikes and compare them to each other, which is something people really search for. So very targeted videos clearly have some point on YouTube. However, most of us can't make those videos. I mean, I try with my mod videos to really try to target what I think people are going to search for, but a lot of the times it surprises me. Like you mentioned before this video, that I had a video where I repack my exhaust, and I just made that kind of out of nothing, and it got a lot of views. I expect nobody to really watch it because, well, there are tons of videos doing that, but for whatever reason...
That wasn't a euphemism. That was actually you repacked your exhaust.
Yeah, I repacked my exhaust.
See, you need Gary to help you word it.
I thought
the title.
It was like you're saying that about something else.
Repack your tailpipe.
Right.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so mufflers need to repacked if they're right. A glass pack, an aftermarket one.
Sure.
And I was just recording all the maintenance of my bike, and that one I just happened to record, and so I was like, oh, why not make this a video? I'm sure that tons of people have done this on YouTube before. But I guess that since I had put in the mileage in there and mentioned that it had been a very long time, since the mufflers had last been repacked, people were interested in watching it because they want to see what it looks like when you don't do the maintenance on your bike for thousands and thousands of miles after really what they should be, just because people are curious about those things. When people usually put videos up, they're putting it up, oh yeah, I did this 20 hours ago of riding time anyway, or 500 miles ago, whenever they recommend to do it, and that just looks normally, but people wonder, what if I don't do this? What? How bad is it? And really, it's one of those things in YouTube, I think, or at least in motovlogging, that you really, or I guess really in anything, actually, any creative content, to just really think about what your audience wants to see, what niche you aren't, isn't, hasn't been filled yet, or likely hasn't been filled yet.
So I have a recommendation for you on that.
All right.
If you ever watch the documentaries online about outlaw motorcycle gangs, the consistent element, which is really annoying, but it's almost, you could make, I could imagine a repacking your exhaust video with this. There's a lot of hard flashing cuts, fast cuts, right? And there's heavy metal guitar in the background. Mm-hmm. I was watching Bass Fishing on TV, and there was heavy metal guitar in the background.
There you
some kind. And so what you need to do for some of these videos, and I'm being quite serious about this, take the most mundane thing, such as repacking your exhaust, and make a lot of very hard, flashy cuts, you know, effects in between frames with a very edgy voiceover that talks like this, and with heavy metal guitar in the background.
Well, you nailed it.
I think it would be brilliant.
I've seen the reverse of that, where some guy was just doing some crazy off-road stuff, and he was just doing a voiceover it where he's completely calm, you know, he's in his house or wherever, in his office later, and he's just, you know, not excited at all. He's just describing what he's doing, and you're just, like, looking at it, and you're like, geez, you look like you're gonna die any moment, and you're just talking about this like it was just a normal afternoon, like you were going fishing.
Yeah, there's all kinds of styles. It's that's what I love about it. Like Zach Attack One, who is out of New York, like near Syracuse area, but he does he'll video his races that he does. He's a young guy in college, and he races on the weekends. He does enduro races or hare scrambles, or what they're called, out in the woods, and he'll video those and then go back and do a narration over them afterwards. So you have that style, and then you have people who record their voice during their ride. And then, you know, like you were saying, I think there's certain, I don't know, feelings about, like, channels that I think of when I think of certain channels. Like, when I think of your channel, I think of the modification videos mostly, because you pretty much ripped your bike down to the last bolt and put it all back together and modified almost everything on that bike. I mean, I saw the one video where you had a list scrolling across the bottom about all the things you did, and I was just like, oh my God, I thought I did a lot to my bike over the last year. That's crazy. But so I think of the modifications with your channel, with like M13, I think about the culture of him living in Taiwan, Accidental Broadcast. I used to watch him when he posted regularly. I think about riding through the, you know, in Maui and through the jungles in Maui and stuff like that. So I think each one kind of grows this feeling of or genre about it over time. And, you know, and I think that's, like you said, it's very specific in some of them. And some of us don't get to do the things that these larger channels can, like comparing two bikes. Where the hell am I going to get another bike, you know? Stop by my local KTM shop. Can I take that Adventure 1190 out and test it for you guys? You know, it's not going to happen. So
tell them about your channel and your viewers. I'm sure they'll just going to love your bike.
I have over 130 subscribers.
That's insane.
KTM shop. So can you imagine those 260 eyeballs are going to see your motorcycle in your shop? How does that sound? Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I'm sold.
Yeah, I'm sold. So anyway, what came out of all your research that you did on these 80 channels that you checked out, the bigger channels? I mean, what did you learn and what did you apply to your channel? Do you care? And is your motivation to grow it like they did? Obviously, if you did market research on the larger channels, there was
intention. Exactly. my motivation was to grow it. I wanted to see how I could best present my channel, what I could do to really grow it more effectively. And the sad thing is I really found that anything that I could do aside from knowing people or really networking, that I couldn't really, it would not really be very effective at getting me anywhere. I mean, I've tried a few things, but in all honesty, I've not really found anything practical that I could do, because you mentioned that just comparing two bikes would be probably the most effective thing, but how am I going to do that? I don't have access to that sort of thing. It's really what I found in the end was what the best thing to do is to do what you know. And what I know, what I've been researching over the past 6 months, was how to modify my motorcycle or modify motorcycles in general. And so, yeah, I just did what I could do.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's what a lot of people used to ask me when I wrote a lot publicly. They're like, well, you know, how do you write so well? And, you know, how do you write things that are interesting? And it's like, I write like I talk. You know, I just write about things I'm really interested in, and I don't try to, like, make it flowery with big words or anything like that. And I just make it sound conversational, and that it comes across as easy to read, and it flows, and it's, you know. So I think, like you said, just stick with what you like, and that's usually going to work. So, Gary, do we have you convinced that you need a dual-sport adventure bike now?
I don't know, man. I got to decide what kind of motorcycler I want to be.
Yeah. Do they call them hogs anymore, still? Or?
I don't know. Yeah. I want a chopper. No, but I mean, actually, you know, Brandon here actually has a chopper because he chops it down.
Yep.
That's the little thing, man. You get a bike stock from the shop. You got to make it yours. You got to take off the stuff that you don't need. You got to do the modifications.
It's so cool. You've got to go to his channel and see that bike because I'm so jealous. I'm like, I keep looking at parts of it, like the engine. He repainted parts of the engine and highlighted parts of it. I'm like, that looks so cool. It's like gold with red. And
well, here's a no joke thing right here. A buddy of mine. For part of his job, he's a videographer, photographer, and he's made instructional videos on how to do automotive repair. I mean, he's a mechanic, licensed mechanic, and so he'll get like a new technology or a new part, and he'll videotape people, instructional videos on how to do it. And one of the things he told me was that when they're doing it, they'll take out all the mistakes or all the problems people have to make more of a seamless how-to. And my argument with him, my suggestion was, well, you should leave those problems in, because people are likely to encounter those same problems and they need to see how people overcome them. And so there's nothing as disheartening as watching someone on YouTube perform some kind of mechanical fix, whether it's on a motorcycle, a car, or a bike, right, where it goes perfectly with no problems, and then you come up with a problem and you're like, what the hell do I do now? And so the fact that, you know, you're making a real quote-unquote video of, here I am, I may or may not know exactly what I'm doing, but I'm like, this is how I figured it out. I think there's a lot of utility and value to those kinds of videos separate from those videos made by experts who don't make any mistakes or people who edit out the mistakes.
And gloss over the things that are obvious to them. That's what I notice a lot with people who teach other things is the ones who are really good at teaching are they don't gloss over the things they think are very common.
Like, and here's a news,
which might be a crucial step.
And here's a news flash. People who know what they're doing don't go on YouTube to find videos on how to do things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So who goes on YouTube to find videos of how to do things are people who don't know what they're doing. And if they're following, and like I was like, you know, my car's at the shop today getting the bearings redone and getting rotors put on. So I just pulled up a YouTube video on how to replace rotors or bearings on a car. And the guy had like a 3-minute description, which was all perfect, but I couldn't follow what the hell he was doing. If I tried to follow his instructions, there'd be no way. And so, you know, going back to, you know, who's your audience and what do they need? I think that by having a person make mistakes and figuring it out and not having everything so locked down in their mind as being an expert, that there's a lot of value in having those kinds of videos online.
Well, and I wanted, my goal was to show my whole experience of it, because I think that there's a value in the story of trying to modify your bike and trying to figure out these parts, because, yeah, people want something that they can relate to, because when people try this out, that I feel like a lot of people would want to know that, oh, well, if I screwed up, I'm not you know, I'm not alone there.
Yeah.
And what you need is basically a Zen and the Utter motorcycle maintenance video thing, right? And so you talk about your literary tropes. You're talking about these various influences, how fixing your motorcycle relates to life or what you can draw from it. You're basically describing that book.
Yeah. And it goes, goes in other aspects too, like running and mountain biking too. There's lots of anyone who's not familiar with or watches YouTube like I do all the time. It's not just like moto vlogging, obviously. There's all kinds of how-tos on, you know, uphill running stuff. I know Scott Jurek did one on hill running and running form and stuff like that. So, you know, take a look. You might find stuff you like or learn, you know, new hobbies. That's where I find stuff. I'm like, wow, I didn't even know that existed. I want to start doing that.
Expand your horizons.
Yeah.
Expand your horizons.
Juggling on unicycles. Cool. There's like a whole moto vlog community on it. So anyway, well, thanks a lot, Brandon, for being on the show today.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Hopefully you get some sleep tonight.
And we need to have him back. We need to kind of see how this thing evolves as we go on, and maybe we can do reviews of other YouTube channels.
Yeah. Well, we will. When he comes out, I'm sure we'll be doing a dual moto vlog, so to speak, on our ride. So I'll post the links to both our channels and those respective videos when we do end up doing that. I'll post it on our Facebook page. And what else do I want to point out? Oh, like I mentioned earlier in the show, we talked about the shirts that are out. The shirts are available. You can purchase those for $20 each. It's only a 7-day window, so it ends on June 4th. So if you want a new Elevation Trail logo shirt, I still have some hats too, please go to our website. And I have a big picture right on the side there. You just click on that and you can order yours, and it will be delivered in a couple weeks. And we appreciate the support. If you feel like donating and showing your support that way, you can click on the PayPal button on elevationtrail.com. And thanks a lot, folks, for listening to the show today. And as always, have fun out there on the trails. And that's a wrap.
Awesome.